Yemenis have extended their congratulations to Palestinian people over the landmark victory of the resistance front against the criminal Israeli regime. They also say Yemen's financial support will persist until Palestinians regain all their usurped territories from the Zionist regime.
The victory of the Palestinian resistance was like a big blow to the Zionist enemy, who didn't expect the power of deterrence and the armed struggle that the Palestinian resistance showed in this battle, which prompted the Zionist entity to begin to recalculate its moves and declare a unilateral ceasefire in the beginning.
The spokesman for the anti-aggression parties of bloc lauded Iran for enhancing the financial and technical capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions. He said Iran has always been playing a key role in supporting the resistance front, mainly in Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria.
The Islamic Republic of Iran played a leading role via the Quds Force, which was led by Martyr Qasem Soleimani, and provided resistance fighters in Gaza with all kinds of weapons and training. There is also missile and financial support, and we thank the leadership in Iran for their unlimited support for the axis of resistance, whether in Palestine or Syria or in Lebanon.
During the 12 days of the Israeli aggression on Gaza, the Israeli attacks have killed scores of Palestinians, including women and children, and wounded more than 1,900 others, according to the Gazan Health Ministry, in what is said to be the fiercest war against Palestinians over the past 7 years.
Yemenis appraised the victory of the Palestinian resistance, saying it is a source of pride for the entire nation. They say this victory is the first step toward the full liberation of all occupied Palestinian territories. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A ceasefire between Israel and Hamas took place on Friday after the worst violence in years, but some clashes broke out around Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds, where similar scenes touched off the Gaza conflict. Israel's bombardment of Gaza stopped after 11 days under a deal brokered by Egypt, which is negotiating with both sides on how to maintain stability. Right after the ceasefire, Palestinians took to streets in Gaza, embracing one another to celebrate the victory against Israel. Mosques also played the song of the victory of the resistance, and people in cars flew Palestinian flags. In order to look into different aspects of this victory, we attended a meeting in which Palestinian officials elaborated on the recent triumph.
It was a great victory for Palestinians because Israel lost around $2 billion following their defeat during this 11-day war. But they also lost billions of dollars as their propaganda machine failed, and all the world now knows about their media hype and the lies that they are trying to disseminate.
Iran's former ambassador to Jordan also talked to the reporters, saying that the Palestinian resistance is getting stronger day by day.
The blockaded Gaza is just 292 square kilometers, and it has been under siege for several years. But the Israeli regime didn't dare to conduct ground operations to occupy this small strip. It shows that Israel has suffered a strategic defeat this time again.
Finally, they set forth plans and ways on how to protect civilians during the wars.
Panelists at this conference also congratulated Palestinians on their great victory against Israel. Human Abedi, Tehran.
South Korea is betting big on semiconductors, with the country's tech giants investing billions of dollars in new plants and the government providing tax breaks. South Korean President Moon Jae-in celebrated construction of new facilities last week.
Our companies are taking a further leap. Over the next decade, Korean chipmakers will invest over 510 trillion won, or $450 billion. Samsung Electronics will construct large-scale production lines for memory semiconductors and system semiconductors at its factories in Pyeongtaek and Hwaseong. And SK Hynix will establish a large-scale production base in Yongin.
This year, a shortage of semiconductors caused production delays and suspensions worldwide. Even South Korea's major car manufacturers Hyundai and Kia had to shut down periodically for lack of the key component.
South Korea produces about 20% of the world's semiconductors. The industry also plays a very important role in the South Korean economy, accounting for 20% of the country's exports. And recently, the price of semiconductors has been quite high, increasing profitability.
Samsung is South Korea's largest company and number one semiconductor producer. But its de facto chief, Lee Jae-young, is in jail, creating a degree of uncertainty amid the massive investment plans.
Samsung's Lee Jae-young is scheduled to complete his 2.5-year prison term in July 2022 for bribing South Korea's former president. But calls are growing in many sectors, including almost two-thirds of the general public, according to a recent survey, for Lee to receive a presidential pardon, considering his company's importance to the South Korean economy.
Samsung is also reportedly planning to construct another U.S. plant with a $17 billion investment. President Moon this week visits the U.S. as American officials seek to reduce tech dependence on China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinians have taken to the streets across the Gaza Strip after a ceasefire between Gaza and Israel went into effect Friday at 2 a.m. local time.
This is a joyful moment for all Gaza. This is the victory for Ramadan, the Eid, and Jerusalem. We will return all the occupied lands, all the cities. If they call us, we will be the first to be with them.
We were watching the media outlets. The victory of the resistance is the victory for all the Muslims. The Palestinian resistance returned the dignity for all Muslims.
People in the occupied West Bank also hit the streets shouting slogans in support of people in Gaza and Palestinian resistance groups. Similar celebrations were held in several other cities around the world. People rallied in the Jordanian border town of Soime to celebrate the Palestinians' victory in the conflict. A car convoy drove through the streets of the Iranian capital, Tehran, in solidarity with Palestinians. Thousands marched in support of the Palestinians across Pakistan and denounced Israel's attacks on the people in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. The ceasefire was brokered and is being monitored by Egypt, which has in the past been involved in intermediary efforts between the two sides. The truce put an end to 11 days of attacks that killed scores of people in the Gaza Strip, including women and children. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire, but this time Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. The resistance groups have described the latest flare-up as a point of departure in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I announce this great victory that our fearless resistance has achieved. It is a divine, strategic, and composed victory during this phase of the struggle with the Zionist enemy. They hit the enemy with a painful and severe strike, which will leave deep marks on this entity, its society, military, security, and political institutions, as well as on its future in the Holy Lands of Jerusalem.
Our fighters were able, through rockets, mortars, and cornet shells, to turn enemy cities and sites into an unfit place for life. We thank the Islamic Republic of Iran, which supported the resistance.
In the meantime, several Israeli political and military figures have questioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motives for launching the offensive on the Gaza Strip and approving a ceasefire without any preconditions or a strategic breakthrough for the regime. Netanyahu's political opponents speculate that the premier ordered the strikes after he failed to establish a coalition cabinet to put an end to Israel's political stalemate. But the developments over the past 2 weeks have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it could face consequences more serious than a political vacuum in Tel Aviv.
Anti-Israel sermons were delivered in Islamic schools across Pakistan. Tens of thousands of people came on the streets alone in Islamabad to voice their support for the Palestinian people. There were similar rallies in other major urban centers to protest over Israel's latest round of nearly 2 weeks long attacks on the Gaza Strip, which left scores of Palestinians dead, many of them women and children. Officially, Pakistan observed the Friday as a Palestinian day to express solidarity with the innocent Palestinians. On the streets, people in Pakistan rage with anger like elsewhere in the Muslim world since Israel attacked and desecrated Islam's third holiest mosque after forcible eviction of Palestinian residents in eastern Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and subsequent unilateral war it imposed on Gaza.
I want for government, he declared jihad. There is the only one solution to liberate Palestinian. It's only way jihad.
The disappointment and feeling of hopelessness among people against Organization of Islamic Cooperation or the OIC are growing to a tipping point. No longer people in Pakistan seem to be taking 57-member bloc of Muslim countries as their genuine representative body.
People in this protest believe that OIC's inaction has emboldened Israel's aggression upon unarmed Palestinians. Therefore, they want Pakistan and other willing Muslim countries for a joint military action against Israel. This demand was partially echoed during a recently held conference of foreign ministers of OIC, where some of the non-Arab states proposed to set up an international force of protection to prevent similar aggression by Israel in future.
Not everywhere in Pakistan, the pro-Palestinian rallies were safe. At least six were killed and over a dozen others were injured after a bomb attack hit a rally in Chaman, southwest of Pakistan. Many suspect pro-Israel terrorist group behind the terror attack.
They want to prevent Pakistani public to attend these rallies. These elements, they fear that if Pakistani public attend these rallies, Pakistani government will get under pressure and they will definitely do something against Israel.
Anti-Israel sentiments run high in Pakistan given the regime's policy of systematically killing innocent Palestinians and evicting them from their homes over the course of decades. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Antidepressants do work for most people and they remain important treatments for depression and anxiety, alongside behavioral and psychological interventions. Nonetheless, anyone thinking of starting an antidepressant should do so in the knowledge that they can sometimes be difficult to stop, and that slow, hyperbolic tapering may be required to minimize any withdrawal symptoms. We have prepared for you an article written by David Taylor, Director of Pharmacy and Pathology at the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust. The piece is titled, COVID has led to record levels of antidepressant use, but withdrawal can be difficult. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of David Taylor's article. One of the impacts of the COVID lockdown since March of 2020 has been a widespread worsening of mental health, with anxiety and depression the most common symptoms reported. According to the NHS Business Services Authority, running parallel to this, the prescription of antidepressants in England has climbed to record levels. In the final 3 months of 2020, there was a reported 6% increase in prescription rates. According to the British government, 17% of the population were taking an antidepressant in 2017-2018, the last year for which figures are available. This rise probably reflects both the increase in diagnosis of depression and anxiety because of the pandemic and the restricted availability of talking therapies during lockdowns. While antidepressants play an important role in treating depression and anxiety, it's essential at this time of increasing usage rates to address how people will ultimately stop treatment. There are no reliable figures for the proportion of people suffering withdrawal reactions after stopping antidepressants, or for the fraction of people who have severe problems. Professor David Taylor writes, "Discontinuation problems vary according to dose, treatment duration, and the individual antidepressant. From my experience, both personal and vicarious, I would estimate that most people, a small majority, have only mild symptoms when stopping, and some, albeit very few, may have no symptoms at all. A good percentage of people, though, will have noticeable symptoms that are at best disturbing and unpleasant, and a small minority will have severe and even disabling symptoms that may linger on for many months or even longer. In my professional life, I've spoken to many patients considering antidepressants about their potential benefits and shortcomings. I also help develop guidelines on the optimal use and on how best to stop treatment with them. Perhaps more importantly, I have also taken antidepressants myself and have gone through the process of stopping them. My personal experience broadly reflects what I hear from patients. Sometimes stopping is easy and sometimes it's awful." Professor David Taylor says, "In 2019, I co-authored a paper in The Lancet Psychiatry that recommended some patients may need to reduce their prescriptions over the course of many months, down to as little as 1/40th of their original dose, before giving them up entirely. Previously, standard advice was to stop taking antidepressants over the course of up to 4 weeks. Some official guidelines introduced in the past few years now reflect the findings of our paper and recommend what is known as hyperbolic tapering. If taken at low doses or for a few weeks or months, antidepressants seldom cause any significant problems when patients stop taking them. However, most current guidelines suggest continuing antidepressant treatment for 6 to 9 months after getting better, to reduce the risk of a relapse into the original condition." Professor David Taylor says, "This advice means more people may suffer some kind of withdrawal symptom when they finally try to reduce their dose. In medical textbooks and official guidelines, I'm informed that stopping antidepressants can lead to a discontinuation reaction. This reaction is usually described as mild and short-lived. I know from personal experience that if you don't do it right, stopping antidepressants can be a pretty horrible experience. Dizziness, nausea, anxiety, panic, mood changes, agitation, insomnia, nightmares, and electric shock sensations are all common symptoms. None are physically dangerous or life-threatening, but neither are they pleasant. This withdrawal syndrome is readily distinguishable from a return of the original depression or anxiety because dizziness, nausea, and electric shocks, known as zaps, are not symptoms of either condition. As well as a prolonged reduction schedule, the dose of antidepressant needs to be lowered in a way that gradually and evenly decreases its pharmacological effects. It may seem logical to reduce from, say, 20 mg a day down to 15 mg, and down to 10 mg, and then to 5 mg, and then stop altogether. However, for complex reasons related to something called the law of mass action, such a reduction schedule will produce even larger reductions in the effect of the antidepressant. Withdrawal symptoms may then get progressively worse with each step down, and some people will find it very difficult to stop if using this method. A dose reduction schedule that looks something like this: 20 mg a day, 10 mg, 7.5 mg, 5 mg, and then 2.5 milligrams, and even down to 1.25 milligrams, and then to 0.625 milligrams, as an example of hyperbolic tapering. It is thought to be the most effective way to reduce the severity of discontinuation symptoms, or even avoid them altogether. The difficulty, though, is that it may sometimes be practically difficult to measure the small doses needed at the end of the taper. Professor Taylor adds, patients have been doing their own hyperbolic tapering for many years, having discovered, often by trial and error, that it is the best method. I have read online accounts of people breaking open their antidepressant capsules and reducing the amount of medication inside by 1 grain each day. Needless to say, it is important to always talk to your prescriber before making any decisions about treatment, and the dosing schedules I give here are for illustrative purposes only. Antidepressants do work for most people, and they remain important treatments for depression and anxiety, alongside behavioral and psychological interventions. Nonetheless, anyone thinking of starting an antidepressant should do so in the knowledge that they can sometimes be difficult to stop, and that slow hyperbolic tapering may be required to minimize any withdrawal symptoms.
The debate.
The Israeli defeat at the hands of the resistance fighters from the Palestinian factions of the Gaza Strip is a huge setback for Israel. What caused Israel to be defeated and buckle in the span of 11 days? Iran's leader has praised the resistance, predicting that the final victory will come to the Palestinians. In this edition of the debate, we'll discuss how close Palestine is in being liberated and what obstacles lie ahead in preventing that from happening. First, let's find out the aftermath of the bombing that took place over the course of 11 days. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon joins us from Gaza City. Ashraf, at this point, more than 11 days has passed, actually. Tell us how Gaza City, where you're at, is surviving and how people are coping with this. Ashraf, do you have us? No, Ashraf is not with us. Okay, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the debate. Professor of Political Science at Brzez University, Saad Nim, joins us from Occupy Ramallah. We also have author and political analyst, Saib Shah, who joins us from Belfast. Gentlemen, welcome. Saib Shah, let me first start with you. The Israeli defeat came at a heavy price for Israel, since Hamas and the resistance factions did not want a ceasefire. That's what was told to us from one of our sources anyways. It was Israel that had actually requested it. Why did Israel, do you think, succumb to the defeat so quickly and only after 11 days, when previous Gaza wars were longer than that?
The idea of yesterday and lately, the Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, walking the streets in Gaza with a couple of bodyguards with his summer shirt only on him, and defying the Zionist entity's war minister, Gantz, who tried to assassinate Sinwar so many times during the last few days. That in itself, this walk and his participation with the people's or Gazan people's celebration of victory, is betrays and show you the balance of deterrence on the ground in Gaza. The other point to answer your question is, when we see the 70% of the Gazan rockets defied the Iron Dome and cheated it and reached to their targets, when we saw the Zionist entity shutting down Ben Gurion Airport near Lod and shifting it to Ramon in the south near Eilat, 202 kilometers away from Gaza, and then the Gazans produce their own Ayash missile with a range of 250 kilometers and hitting that airport, shutting the airspace over the Zionist entity. The Zionist entity, by the way, before this criminal war in Gaza, were bragging to especially the markets in West Europe tourism that it's a free, corona-free zone. All of this population got the jabs of the corona, and so it's safe for the Europeans to enjoy the beaches of Tel Aviv and that. This was denied by the resistance for them. Their streets were deserted. Their beaches were deserted. Their factories were closed. Their industry was shut down. Their shekel lost nearly 20% of its value. Their economy is in tatter within 11 days. When you see the oil and gas industry being affected in their fields, gas field near the north of Gaza, shut down, which sells its gas to Jordan and Egypt. We don't know when it's going to reopen. All right. When they see storage.
I do apologize. Because we have Ashraf Shana, our correspondent there, Saib Shah, with us now. We're connected. Let me go to him to get an idea about what's going on at the Strip. We'll come right back to you, if you don't mind. Ashraf, tell us about the aftermath of what we're looking at. How are Gazans dealing with the destruction that has happened at this point to the Gaza Strip?
Yes, nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza are still struggling to cope with what happened for 10 days in this tiny blockaded enclave by the hands of the Israeli regime forces. Tel Aviv destroyed thousands of housing and commercial units in the enclave, and also killed scores of women and children, elderly people, and people from all professions, including at least 60 children. The UN UNRWA, one of the UN agencies in charge of Palestinian refugees, has condemned the killing of Palestinian students who are refugees. And the situation is still very tough, as Israel continues to place tight restrictions on the Gaza Strip. The Kerem Shalom crossing, the sole commercial crossing with Gaza, still sealed. And this means no humanitarian aid will be coming in, at least from from that commercial crossing. And the Egyptians as well, in the south of the enclave, have not allowed enough aid to reach the people of Gaza.
Thank you very much for that, Ashraf. We do appreciate it. Saib Shah, I'm going to come right back to you and have you continue where you took off before we go to Saad Nim.
So what I was saying, the devastation, the Palestinian resistance caused the Zionist entity economy, and their population lost the trust in their military leadership and their air power as well, and the Iron Dome. Usually, the Zionist entity always, when they have a problem, and they said, give it to the army. In 2006, they said, when they failed against the Lebanese resistance, said, give it to the Air Force to deal with it. Today, their Air Force, with using even F-35, couldn't destroy the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. The opposite happens. The Palestinian resistance managed to target the nerve centers, their strategic military bases and air bases, reach every corner in Palestine. And by the way, this was handmade by Palestinians who were diving, looking for ships. British ships sank in front of Gaza in the First World War, and take explosion from it and using it, sewage pipes, old Israeli rockets fired at Gaza, recycling it. This ingenuity, of course, as the resistance said, it was provided the know-how by Iran and by Syria, and as well the help of Hezbollah. They thank the states who stood by them, but the cost for the Zionist entity was huge. They didn't
expect that. That's the point I'd like to get at. I'd like to expand on that with you, Sadnim, the cost that, as our guest there, Saab Shaf, indicated for Israel. At what cost did this war come for Israel? We could talk about the different angles and different events surrounding the consequences of this war, but you tell us what you think those are.
Good evening to you and all your viewers, as well as for your guest. As a matter of fact, we can talk about a different angle, as you said, exactly why we could call it a victory for the Palestinians and a huge defeat for the Israelis. It's not only of what your guest had mentioned, which is great, yes, to give this picture about what happened in Israel, but at the same time, which is most importantly, it's united the Palestinian people. For the very first time, we are talking about Palestinians who are living inside the occupied territories of 1948 in West Bank, in Gaza, Jerusalem, as well as in the refugee camps, Lebanon and in Jordan. That unification for the Palestinian people was the first for the first time. And I believe that we are on the verge of a new era after this war. Things are changing now. I don't know exactly how that is going to be in the coming future, but definitely it is a change, and a huge change, and the Israelis are feeling that. The campaign that the Israelis are going on today and the last few days against the Palestinians inside 1948 occupied territories, it's over 500 people. Over 500 people were arrested, and they're having a list of people who wanted to arrest more and more. It became, you know, really pressuring on their nerve. It became really a kind of a danger. We are talking about the third and the fourth generation who are living inside Israel. The Israeli had described them as those are the young people of the TikTok and the Facebook and the social media, and they are not that much interested in the political issues. But apparently that these youngsters inside the Palestinian occupied territories did not forget, and they are calling the Israelis who are living with them in the same cities sometimes, like in Ramallah and in Lod, Haifa, they call them for the first time settlers, exactly as we in the West Bank calling the Israeli in our territory settlers. So this is a huge change coming to Palestinians, and we believe that this change is going to, we should bank on it. That's the most important thing. Okay. I believe that.
All right, this is the, I mean, it's great. Okay, Sadnim, I appreciate that. I'm sure many of the points that you made there, I'm assuming, Saab Shaf, you agree with it. Many people agree with it. Many people are saying this time it's different. There's going to be big changes. You know, this all sounds great, but Saab Shaf, let's really get down to reality here. How will there be change? The only thing that came to the rescue of Palestinians was the promise that the Palestinian factions and Hamas resistance group made. The promise that it's going to not allow Israel to treat Palestinians the way that it was at the last Hamas compound. And it came through with that promise of 6 p.m., I believe, local time, in Jerusalem, outlets where the rockets came. That was the only thing that rescued the Palestinians from being treated that way. This time around, everybody says it's different. How can we expect change to take place?
You see, Palestinian people believe religiously Palestine called the land of Rebat, which is the land of people steadfastness against occupation. And this is a major factor in their psyche. And when the people, as you said, mentioned in Jerusalem, they called for health and Islamic heritage, we have the line wa mu'tasima. When a woman called on Khalifa for help, the Khalifa sent an Islamic an empire sent an army to help the woman when she was subjugated to abuse. Today, when the people of Jerusalem seeked help, they said, Yalla Gaza, Yalla Gaza, which means, come on Gaza, calling their armed resistance. They knew their armed resistance would let them down. And as you said, the armed resistance in Gaza Strip give the time and date and ultimatum to the Zionist entity. But their arrogance, ignoring the strength of the Gazan, and showed the failure of their military intelligence. And the Gazan answered to save the people in Jerusalem, to support them, and as well, as your guest said, to help and encourage the unification of the Palestinian in 1948, or the behind the green light, as they say, and the West Bank to go all and erupt in supporting their brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. And that worked. And this is today will put all the deals the Palestinian Authority done before, when Oslo Agreement is absolute, and they throw it to the dustbin of history, if you want to call it. So the new generation today, if we witness in Jerusalem, they are all young. In the West Bank, they are all young. In the 1948, they are all young. Those people, they prove they are still active in a national liberation struggle against a colonial entity. And as your friend, my friend, colleague said, settlers, no, we call them colonial settlers. These colonial settlers in the West Bank, or in 1948, when we witnessed what happened, especially in Lod, and before that in Umm al-Fahim. Umm al-Fahim, I'll see how they were working in harmony. When they sent their murabitun, or supporters, to support the people during Ramadan month in Al-Aqsa Mosque, they blocked their way, the Zionist entity, the buses. They don't want to let them enter Jerusalem. Other cities in Palestine with Arabic population in there blocked the nerve roots of the traffic in the Zionist entity. And when they opened and allowed the people of Mifahim, they left it to blockade themselves. So this is magnificent to see the major Palestinian youth, who the Zionists wanted to corrupt with the drugs, wanted to corrupt the and criminally and frame them into a lot of issues. They turned their back and all of that, and used the weapons the Zionist police gave them to target the Zionist entities' police.
All right. Well, Sadnir, there's going to be some kind of movement here. They can't go back to the status quo. I'm assuming that, based on the martyrs, at least at a minimum, that Palestine gave, which is upwards around 286, if I'm recalling it correctly. Many of them children. And also Israel had on its side 11 deaths. Now, I'd like to zoom in on the U.S. role and ask you, first of all, quickly assess the role it had to play in the Israeli ceasefire. We don't know as of yet whether it did have a role or not. It did take some time for the U.S. to respond to the Israeli onslaught, repeating the lie that Israel has the right to self-defense. Tell us how you see the U.S. To have played a role in that ceasefire, if it did. And then the big question here, how could the U.S. be impartial and hold a desire to stop the war when it gives Israeli military aid? And the condition on that is that if it buys its military equipment only from the U.S., As one analyst has said, the U.S. had assured Israel that it would cover its military costs for this war.
Yeah, I would start where you ended. Definitely, the Americans are not going to be impartial at all. They are always going to be in support of Israel. All American administrations were in support of Israel, and this one does not differentiate itself from the other administrations. But from the very beginning, after the elections and the Biden administration came around, they had other interests. The Middle East was not in their focal point at this point. They had other problems, like the problems with Russia, with China, with the Iranian deal, the nuclear deal, and all these kind of things. The Middle East was not even in their mind. But this war brought them back in a very short time. The Americans did not want to interfere that much, but apparently the pressure, international pressure on Biden administration to stop the war and to condemn Israel was very urgent, to the extent that Biden called Netanyahu so many times, more than six times during the war, tried to convince him to stop and to end this war. But apparently Netanyahu had his own ideas about going on, trying to gain as much as he could to remain as a prime minister in Israel. Now the Americans, by the end of the day, they became really fed up with the Israelis, since there were lots of pressure and the Israelis were doing nothing but killing children and women. So they forced them to stop the war, and that's what had helped a lot in interpreting the whole war as a defeat to Israel as well.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. That was Said Nimr, professor of political science at Brzez University. Thank you. And author and political analyst, Saab Shah, it's a pleasure to see you. Thank you for your thoughts. And we had Ashraf Shannon, correspondent from Gaza City. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. When we come with Hawaii, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Negotiations in Congress over some of President Biden's key priorities are facing new headwinds, dimming Democrats' hopes that they might be able to overcome the partisan gridlock that has come to define Washington and quickly broker deals with Republicans to push through their ambitious agenda. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Katie Edmondson, Chris Cameron, and Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, As Talks Bunk Down, Hopes for Bipartisan Deal on Biden's Priorities Dim. Negotiations in Congress over some of President Biden's key priorities are facing new headwinds, dimming Democrats' hopes that they might be able to overcome the partisan gridlock that has come to define Washington and quickly broker deals with Republicans to push through their ambitious agenda. After congressional Democrats muscled through Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion pandemic stimulus bill in March over Republican opposition, lawmakers went back to the negotiating table, opening bipartisan talks on a slew of its legislative priorities, such as infrastructure and policing reform. While those discussions are continuing, optimism for bipartisan breakthroughs has waned. The Biden administration and Republicans are sparring over the size of his infrastructure bill, remaining in a deadlock on a revived drive to overhaul the nation's policing system, and lawmakers are waging a partisan fight over an independent commission to investigate last January's attack on the Capitol. Any sustained impasse, especially on issues as straightforward as the January 6th commission, will almost certainly ratchet up pressure on moderate Senate Democrats, who have insisted that their party must work across the aisle to broker bipartisan compromises. But the deadlocks also threaten to eat up more time on the legislative calendar as the administration presses to notch wins on a packed queue of even thornier political issues, including voting rights and immigration. The reaction on Sunday, 23rd of May, by one of Republicans most willing to cross party lines, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, illustrated the depth of the impasse on infrastructure, even after offers and counteroffers on both sides. While Susan Maine said that negotiations should continue on a $1.7 trillion infrastructure counterproposal that Joe Biden made last Friday, her position had not moved. The White House bill was simply too big. "I think we're still pretty far apart, but this is the test. This will determine whether or not we can work together," Susan Collins said in an appearance on ABC's This Week program, stressing that the combined $4 trillion proposed value of Joe Biden's infrastructure and economic agenda is an enormous sum of money. The counteroffer that the Biden administration sent Senate Republicans on Friday, 21st of May, cut more than $500 billion off the president's initial proposal. White House officials hoped the concession would jumpstart the talks, but Republicans swiftly rejected it. "I was glad that the president put a counteroffer on the table, but if you look closely at it, what he's proposing to do is move a lot of the spending to a bill that's already on the Senate floor," Susan Collins said. She was referring to a legislative package meant to bolster the nation's technological and manufacturing abilities in a bid to outcompete China. That might be the Senate's best chance of passing bipartisan legislation in the coming months. Senator Roy Blunt, a Republican from Missouri, said on Sunday, 23rd of May, that he believed lawmakers had a week or 10 days to decide if Republicans and Democrats would be able to cut a deal on infrastructure. He pointed to the vast gulf between the Biden administration and congressional Republicans, who have said that his plan is insufficiently targeted on what they consider traditional infrastructure, such as roads and bridges. "Our biggest gap is not the money," Senator Roy Blunt said. "Our biggest gap is defining what infrastructure is, and if we get to a definition of infrastructure that the country would have always accepted, that becomes a much narrower space than it appears to be right now." President Biden has said repeatedly that he wants a bipartisan infrastructure deal, and his aides have expressed openness to a compromise with Republicans that could narrow the scope of the president's ambitions. Such a deal would leave Democrats to try to pass large swathes of his economic agenda through the fast-track budget reconciliation process, which would not require any Republican votes, but would pose another difficult challenge. Holding together the progressive and moderate Democrats who formed the party's thin congressional majorities to approve trillions of dollars in spending and tax increases. But in a letter to Republican senators on Friday, White House officials made clear that they expected Republicans to expand their view of what should be included in any infrastructure deal, challenging them to fund spending on home health care for older people and disabled Americans and a robust national network of charging stations for electric vehicles, among other areas. "We remain concerned that your proposal excludes entirely some investments that are key to our competitiveness and have garnered bipartisan support," the administration officials wrote. In an optimistic sign, a bipartisan group of senators announced on Saturday that they had reached an agreement on a $304 billion transportation bill, a notable breakthrough as lawmakers continue to spar over Joe Biden's broader infrastructure proposal. However, Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont independent senator who is the Budget Committee chairman, suggested on Sunday that the infrastructure packages would still probably have to go through reconciliation with entirely Democratic votes. If Republicans continue to balk at the price tag and the scale of Joe Biden's proposals. The Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said, "We would like bipartisanship, but I don't think we have a seriousness on the part of the Republican leadership to address the major crises facing this nation. If they're not coming forward, we've got to go forward alone." Negotiations have also stalled on policing reform, with three lawmakers still unable to reach an agreement on how or whether to alter the legal liability shield for individual police officers, known as qualified immunity, to make it easier to bring civil lawsuits against police officers for wrongdoing. Disagreement over whether to change that doctrine had doomed attempts to pass policing legislation last summer amid a national outcry for reform. Joe Biden had hoped lawmakers would broker a deal before 25th of May, the anniversary of the death of George Floyd, an African-American who was murdered by a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But a breakthrough has remained elusive despite continued closed-door negotiations between Representative Karen Bass, a Democrat from California, and Senators Cory Booker, a Democrat from New Jersey, and Tim Scott, a Republican from South Carolina. "We want to eliminate qualified immunity, and that is where we're starting," Cory Booker said in an interview broadcast on CNN's State of the Union program on Sunday. Cory Booker added, "Clearly you've heard very publicly the red lines on the other side. And again, this is one of the big issues that we're working very hard to see if we can bridge this wide gulf." Prospects to create an independent commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol assault also dimmed last week as Republican leaders dug in against the commission in an attempt to doom its prospects in the Senate, even though one of their own House members negotiated its details with Democrats. The Republican leaders of both chambers, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky and Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, have opposed the creation of such a panel. Mitch McConnell warned that Democrats had partisan motives in moving to set up the commission and would try to use it as a cudgel against Republicans in the 2022 midterm elections.